Improve it, peeps. Welcome to today's show. Oh my gosh, I am so excited that you're here. If we have never met, I'm Erin Deal, the founder of the professional development company Improve It. We use improv comedy to train professionals, leaders, and teams on power skills. I'm also the host of this show. So welcome to the Improve It podcast. I'm an author and a keynote speaker, and I am here today to chat with you. If you are an OG Improve It peep, welcome back, my friends. I am so excited to have you here for today's show. This month, y'all, is incredible. We're talking all about stepping into your power. So every 4 weeks, we change themes on this show, and that is the theme for this month. And boy, do I have a powerful message for you. Now, before we go any further, quick housekeeping item. My book is out in the world. And if you have not gotten your copy, you can go to itserindeal.com. You will see all the links where you can buy the book at your retailer of choice and also support those small local businesses. It's going to be in a lot of local bookstores as well. So check it out. Grab your copy of my book, I See You, A Leader's Guide to Energizing Your Team Through Radical Empathy. Let's start talking about today's guest, because today I'm chatting with the one, the only, Chris Voss, everyone. Chris Voss is no joke. This interview is a pinch me frickin' moment. Let me tell you about Chris Voss. Chris used his many years of experience in international crises and high-stake negotiations to develop a unique program that applies globally proven techniques to the business world. Prior to 2008, Chris was the lead international kidnapping negotiator for the FBI, as well as the FBI's hostage negotiation representative for the National Security Council's Hostage Working Group. During his career, he also represented the U.S. government as an expert in kidnapping at two international conferences sponsored by the G8. Now, before he was the FBI's lead international kidnapping negotiator, he served as the lead crisis negotiator for the New York City division of the FBI. He was a member of the New York City Joint Terrorist Task Force for 14 years. He was a case agent on TerrorStop and the TWA Flight 800 catastrophe. He also negotiated the surrender of the first hostage taker to give up in the Chase Manhattan bank robbery. He has had a 24-year tenure with the Bureau, but before that and during that, he was trained in the art of negotiation by not only the FBI, but also Scotland Yard and Harvard Law School. He is also a recipient of the Attorney General's Award for Excellence in Law Enforcement and the FBI Agents Association Award for Distinguished and Exemplary Service. He has taught business negotiation at MBA programs all over the world. And since 2009, he's also worked with the Insight Security as their managing director of the kidnapping resolution practice. Y'all, this episode is going to blow your mind. If you want to become a better negotiator in high stakes negotiations, or you want to become a better negotiator in general, or you want to have more impactful and meaningful conversations with the people you lead, your families, your teams, your communities, your organizations, press play. You're already pressing play. Keep playing it, because this episode is going to blow your mind. Chris is a phenomenal storyteller. I'm going to just stop blabbing and let Chris do the talk, and let's get to improving it with Chris Voss. Okay, this is something I've been waiting all day for. Improve it, peeps. Get ready, because we have the one, the only, Chris Voss on this show. Welcome, Chris, to the Improve It podcast.
Thank you, Erin. A pleasure for me to be here.
I mean, This feels already fun. I just don't even know. This is like improv. I have no idea where it's going. I know where I want to take it, but all I have right. No idea where it's going. So let me ask you this, just to start off our conversation. What is one word, an intention, if you will, that you want to set for our conversation today?
Oh, wow. Growth.
Ooh, I love that. Why growth? I just want to ask you that.
Well, it should be a steady goal constantly all the time. And I didn't put any adjectives around it, you know, like not maximum growth, not minimal. I mean, if you're looking to grow just a little bit every day, the accumulation will come to you really fast. So just, you know, just growth at all, and you're on the right track.
That's right. I love that. And I will tell you, I'm a lifelong learner. And those little hours add up. Even if you say, hey, I'm going to give myself 10 minutes today to do something for myself, that adds up over time. So I love that. And I want to talk about you, obviously, and your journey, your growth. But I also want to talk about this idea that we're talking about all month, which is standing in your power, which is something that I know you have had to do your entire career. But what does that, when I say those words, what does standing in your power mean to you?
I think it would just be standing yourself, standing who you are. And there's all these cliches out there, you know, be you, everybody else is taken, all that nonsense. And it's not nonsense, it's true. I mean, if you just focus on being who you are, That's where your power is. So, you know, be, develop, grow you.
Yeah. Has there been a moment in your career where you really stood in your power, where you knew, like, this is who I am? I'm not trying to change. Was there a moment that's really pinnacle that you could pinpoint?
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think when I first started the training for the hostage negotiation to be a crisis negotiator with the FBI, I mean, I'd been through actually a really difficult period of time in my professional life. Difficult is always a relative term, but it was the toughest time on me personally. And when I remember standing in a hallway waiting for the elevator at the dormitories, the FBI Academy of Quantico, and looking out the window. And thinking, like, you know, this is where this has led me. And I was really happy with it at that point in time.
Wow. I mean, your career is fascinating to me. I do comedy for a living. Okay. It's the opposite.
Hey, who doesn't?
Right. You're right. Who doesn't? But so when you think about standing in your power, the negotiations that you have had to do, and this idea that you talk about in your books or your book, which I know we have potentially one in development, breaking news, but your book, when you talk about this idea of tactical empathy as it relates to standing in your power, how do those two things go hand in hand?
Well, it starts with just defining what empathy is and what it was originally and what it's become synonymous to. I mean, empathy is just understanding, demonstrated understanding. It's not agreement. It's not disagreement. It's not liking, you know, drawing really fine lines on it. And so you can completely understand somebody, no matter how diametrically opposed they are to you and every one of your core values. It's not accepting it. It's not rejecting it. And so take empathy to start with and have it be demonstrating understanding, which is not understanding. It's demonstrating understanding. Doesn't matter if you understand, if you keep your mouth shut.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we put the word tactical in front of it to begin with, just to make it a little more palatable to people that were afraid of the word, thinking it was weakness or sympathy. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, they're teaching SEALs, Navy SEALs, how to breathe. And they're like, all right, so we're going to teach you yoga breathing today. And the SEALs go, we're not doing that. And they go, well, we're going to teach you tactical breathing. They go like, oh, okay, we could do that.
Yeah, that's so funny. Do you know Jason Redman? We had Jason Redman on this show. Do you know who Jason Redman
is? I'm not acquainted with him.
Oh, okay. He's a former Navy SEAL. I feel like I need to have you and him on this show together. That would be one of my favorite podcasts in the history of podcasts. Because he actually is a speaker and an author and all the things as well. And it's just so interesting because when you say, when people put, say the word empathy in business or to a Navy SEAL, it has this almost, not negative connotation, but it has this almost connotation of the word love, which a lot of people don't like to use in business.
Yeah.
So tell me, what are your thoughts about bringing these two words to life? Because a lot of the speaking you do, it's to organizations and to corporations. How is tactical empathy impactful in organizations, and why is it so important?
Well, it maximizes success. It's really the key to collaboration and long-term trusted relationships. Now, there's a lot of short-term thinking in the world, let alone in business. And if you're really greedy, you know, there was a Goldman Sachs executive a long time ago that said, Gus Levy, I believe was his name, greedy, yes, but long-term greedy. You begin to realize that the more trusted relationships you have, the wealthier you are. You know, your short-term gain, long-term loss. You know, steady, solid relationships. And you can't have a long-term relationship with somebody if you don't understand them and demonstrate that you understand them. And then the next issue is, do your core values line up? But it really starts with, you know, do you understand who you're dealing with? Do they understand you? That's empathy, understanding. And then demonstrating that understanding so the two of you get on the same page.
Okay. So this has never happened in the history of this podcast, but I want to go down this line here.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
Buckle up.
Okay, here, I've got my seatbelt on. So thinking about the negotiations that you had to do in your career, could you describe, just give us a case study of where you used tactical empathy in a high stake negotiation? Can we?
Yeah, it's what.
Yeah, go for it. Let me, my seatbelt is on.
That's one of the, you know, one of the my favorite stories from the book. First big kidnapping that I worked in the Philippines. Terrorists on the other side. I mean, they are Bond villains, as bad as you can imagine. One guy in particular, he actually had told the media at one point in time he thought a movie should be made about him. Dude named Abu Sabaya.
Yeah.
Very bad guy. Liked to wear sunglasses because, you know, he thought he was a dashing, daring Bond villain. And we started hitting him with what was, I now realize, was tactical empathy. You know, the FBI negotiation skills are what we use as a basis for tactical empathy. And we just, if you will, can you imagine weaponizing, hammering a guy with empathy? Ultimately, our hostage walks away. There was a $10 million ransom demand for him. And it went on for months until finally, you know, we softened them up so quietly, in such a stealth mode and in an invisible way, you know, that our hostage ultimately just walks away. What does that mean? What that means is bad guys didn't get a dime. In a high stakes, high gain, high dollar business, and there was previously a kidnapping about a year earlier where another group associated with these terrorists got $20 million. And our guys in this particular case were envious of the $20 million ransom demand that the other guys got. They get zero. And when it's all said and done, I'm back in the Philippines a couple weeks afterwards. I'd coached a negotiator. I was an international negotiation coach. And I catch back up with the negotiator that I'd coached about 3 weeks later in the Philippines. And he said, "You're not going to believe who called me on the phone." And I'm like, "All right, you know, I don't know. Who called you?" And it was our Bond villain from the previous case. I said, "Wow, really? What did he say?" He said, "Have you been promoted yet? You're really good at what you do. I was going to kill the American. You kept me from it. And I just wanted you to know that I think they should promote you."
Wow.
And that's empathy on a bad guy.
I have full body chills right now. That is intense. Insane. I hope he recorded that phone call. I would listen to that phone call again and again. I'd take it all the way up.
Yeah.
That is nuts. So
yeah, it was nuts.
Can I get real specific? What were some of the things that you coached the negotiator on? What are there specific tactics that you used to create that?
Yeah, what we really did, you know, you start bundling tactics to get a really powerful moment. The most powerful moment you could get, the real breakthrough, is when you get the other side to give you a "that's right" as a response, which is an epiphany, a revelation. And it's one of the reasons why we'd call it tactical empathy, and because it's guided by neuroscience. You give somebody an epiphany, they get this great cocktail of neurochemicals, which changes their mindset towards you. They're going to get hit with their own oxytocin and serotonin. And these are a combination of bonding drug, truth drug, and a drug of satisfaction. And to get them to that point, our bad guy had been giving all sorts of rationale for the kidnapping and an amount of money they were looking for that made no sense. That doesn't matter that it doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't matter if it's true. You know, you can't handle the truth, the famous movie.
Yeah.
Line. What is it to the other side? How do they see it? And we'd struggled in this case for a couple of months. And I coached the negotiator. All right, so next time we get our Bond villain on the phone, you're going to get a "that's right" out of him. You're going to summarize not the situation as it is, but the situation as he sees it, along with literally a 500-year justification for their position. You know, people's memories of the past, which in point of fact have no bearing on today's facts, are still their memories of the past and their justifications for their nonsense. And I said, you know, we're gonna justify his perspective, not ours, and not the facts, the other guy's perspective. And you're gonna lay it on thick. If you're not laying their perspective on thick, you're not laying it on thick enough. If you don't feel like you're overdoing it, you're not hitting it hard enough. And we were going for the magical "that's right" as a response. I actually put it in a document that I shared with the embassy as to why we were doing it. And what impact we thought it was going to have. Because when I was coaching and training these negotiations internationally, I did nothing without the explicit permission of the American ambassador in charge of the country. Never went outside the lines. I was a consultant. The ambassador had total control over everything we always did. So I would write up strategy documents, and they were kind of like, okay, if you say so, if you think this is going to be that big of a deal, like, we don't even think that you're going to be able to get him to say it. That's right. The fact that you think you can predict what a terrorist is going to say is almost laughable to us. But if you think you could do it, knock yourself out. So I get my negotiator on the phone, who previously, by the way, was the Philippine equivalent of a SEAL commander. So he was trainable. We were talking about the SEALs earlier. The best SEALs are trainable. That's all you need from anybody. And he was trainable, and he lays on the other guy's perspective, 500 years of oppression, on and on and on. And the critical moment is when you're done, you have to shut up. You can't say, "Have I got that right?" You can't say, "What did I leave out?" You have to finish your summary, and you have to go dead silent, because you put the other person in a particular part of their brain and you got to let it bake. You got to let it seep in. If you say a word, it puts them in another part of their brain. And he finished the entire summary and we go dead silent. And those silent moments are excruciating to sit there and wait. And that's what we did. And a few moments later, the Bond villain says, "That's right." And my negotiator, and they sit there in silence for a couple more moments. And he says, "You know, let's talk again in a couple of days." And they hang up the phone. Now, at the beginning of this phone conversation, there was a $10 million ransom demand for the hostage. And when the phone hung up, the ransom was never mentioned again. It was just gone. It vanished. We went through the case a couple a couple more twists and turns. Ransom never came up again. And then a couple of months afterwards, our hostage walked away. And 3 weeks later, our Bond villain called.
That is insane. Okay, I have so much I want to unpack from this. Okay, so much. Okay, first, can I ask you, I study a lot about the brain and positive and negative thinking. Was the part of the brain that you were trying to activate the frontal lobe? Or is there a specific part of the brain that you were trying? What is the specific part of the brain?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, we're trying to get completely around a frontal lobe, the prefrontal cortex, all of that. You know,
Yeah. There's
a lot of discussion as to what that does in a brain. Some people call it the executive function.
Yes.
Some people just say it's just a traffic cop.
Yeah.
But what's really the important areas, and as a layman, so, you know, by no means, no PhD in neuroscience or neural anatomy.
Yep, right here. I am a PhD, pretty huge deal. Okay, but that's
right.
Keep going, Chris. Keep going. Got it all day.
Yeah.
But okay, so it's your frontal lobe, right? That's what they're active. You're trying to.
Well, we're trying to get into the limbic system. We're trying to get into, it's an oversimplification into the portions of the amygdala where the negative thinking is, and we're trying to deactivate it.
Yeah.
You know, suck all the electricity out of it entirely.
Yes.
And then when the neurochemicals get kicked in, I'm not entirely sure of how or why or where they come from, but we're really intentionally trying to activate very specific neurochemicals.
So interesting. And then the tactical empathy piece, you are speaking about this person. You are putting yourself in that person's shoes. You are literally saying, I'm going to try on a pair of your Nike Dunks. And that's how we're going to conduct this conversation, as if I'm almost speaking in first person as you.
Yeah. You know, and there's some really subtle, it depends upon a person how you want to define it. Like to me, to put yourself in somebody else's shoes is to feel it. And you don't have to feel it.
Yeah.
To see it from their perspective is to identify it.
Right.
And for me, I need that distinction. Because I don't need to feel it. And quite frankly, you don't care if I feel it. You care if I can see it. And whether or not I feel it is completely irrelevant to you. You want to know that I see it. And so that's why, for me personally, I make the distinction between seeing it from their perspective versus walking in their shoes. Because I don't need to feel it in order to be able to identify it. Like, I don't need to be able to feel your sense of loss to say that to you, that feels like you get kicked in the gut. You feel like you get kicked in the head. A very good friend of mine died about 3 years ago, and it was devastating for his wife. Phenomenal human being, Sean Stevenson, one of the world's God's gifts to the planet. If there ever was one, Sean Stevenson was one. And the first time I spoke to his widow after he died, I said, you probably feel like, not that you got ran over by a train, but that a train fell on you. And I didn't have to feel that personally. I couldn't imagine the depth of the devastation to feel it, but I could do my best to call it out. And she appreciated that response. She didn't care. I was hurting because Sean died, but nothing compared to what she was going through.
Yeah. That recognition.
So I just tried to describe it.
This is just fascinating on so many levels. I want to touch on one more thing that you said. I've literally thrown all my notes out the window. I've got nothing but this conversation because it's just blowing my mind. The power of the pause at the end. So again, relating this to my world in improv, we do that when we have what we call the economy of words on stage. We might say a few words and then pause because we're waiting for our scene partner to, this is again, low stakes. I mean, these are low stakes. We're talking the flip side of the high stakes, but it does do something to the person in that scene. It allows that person to take in that information and to respond and justify that response in a meaningful and authentic way. Can you describe in this high stake negotiation why that pause is so important?
Well, you got to let what you've said sink in. I mean, again, very much layman's terms. If I'm summarizing and I'm triggering your emotional responses, you know, I want it to run its course. I want it to go all the way through. And if I speak up, there's a pretty good chance. If I say, do I have that right? I pull you into a different part of your brain. I stop the process in one section and I light you up someplace else. And it probably short-circuited the process, the triggering of the neurochemicals in the other section. Because if I ask you a question of any sort, it probably pulls you back up into the prefrontal cortex, like we were talking before. You engage again in executive thinking or traffic cop thinking. You begin to formulate a response. And what I did was stop the process that I had going before, and I probably stopped it too soon. So I needed to go sink all the way in. I needed to go through every molecule, hit every synapse in whatever part of that brain that I'm hitting, and then wait for you to then avail yourself of the freedom of response at your choice.
Wow. Can I say this? You also do a great succinct ending in how you talk, just naturally. It's so nice. Like, you're always just like, and boom. It's nice and it lands and it allows people to take in what you've said. And I think a lot of people in the go, you're welcome. Take that in because it's thoughtful, but I can see in a high stakes scenario why it makes sense with the science behind it, the neuroscience behind it, but what it does for the person you're communicating with. Now, okay, all of this to say, I wanted this backstory because it's fascinating. We've literally never had anyone like you on the show. So in 3 years, you are a first. So let me ask you this. I have so many people who listen to this show who are people leaders. They lead teams, whether they're small or large. They lead organizations and communities. We all negotiate all day long. How do we take this case study and apply it to the people that we serve? How do we communicate using tactical empathy, but also negotiate so that both parties end up being happy? Because in a leadership scenario, I don't necessarily always need to get what I want. I just need to meet that person at some mutual understanding. So how do you take negotiation from what your career was built upon and put it into a leadership position?
Well, it's about accelerating collaboration and accelerating them following your direction. You know, the biggest friction to them following your direction as a leader is going to be their second thoughts. Were they understood? Do you understand? Have you taken everything into account that I've taken into account? And that's going to create, if they don't know that, if the people that are following you don't know that, it's going to create long-term friction that's going to slow everything down. And so the summary to demonstrate an understanding of what their perspective is really about how do you shift into a higher gear. And, you know, the today's car transmissions, it's not as obvious a moment, but in the old car transmissions, I mean, you had to pull a car out of gear, push in a clutch, to shift into the next higher gear. You know, there's this moment that's required to accelerate. And demonstrating understanding is very much along those lines. And it's mostly driven around negative thinking. The big friction to collaboration is negative thinking. And you don't get away from negative thinking by denying it. You deactivate it by observing it. You go from, I don't want you to think I don't understand, to you probably think I don't understand. The first was the denial. The second one was an observation. A number of years ago, we're doing a negotiation training for a hospital holding company, and we're laying this thing out called the accusations audit, which is listing out the negative thoughts that the other side has. And these guys are going like, yeah, well, you know, our CEO did that recently. You know, we've got all this change in the medical industry, and this was back when they were getting ready to kick Obamacare into gear, and there was all this, the health services industry is up, and I have no idea what's going on. And there's a lot of friction in the company to implement the CEO's vision of what he wants to do. So he calls everybody together. He brings everybody together in one place. And they're like, he's probably going to tell us what to do. He's probably going to get angry at us because we're not following orders. And he stands up in front of them and he goes, you probably think I'm crazy. You probably think I'm not listening to what's going on here. You probably think I'm completely out of touch. You probably think I don't know where the kind of stress you're under. And they all kind of went, wow, he does get us. So taking the time to do this really inefficient thing, to bring everybody together so he could show them he knew what they were thinking, not to tell them what to do, not even to give them a pep talk, you know, not to say, our greatest days are ahead of us. You know, we're awesome. We got such a great team. What he did was he got up in front of everybody and shared openly what their reservations were about his leadership by saying, this is probably what you guys are thinking. And they go to feeling understood. And it deactivated it eliminated the friction. Everybody kicked it into gear then. They went like, all right, so this guy's not an idiot. He is aware of all this stuff. He does appreciate our perspective. He didn't say, I understand what you're feeling. He said, this is what you're feeling. And then he named it. You know, the I understand what you're feeling is a horrible attempt at connecting. You got to tell people what it is that you understand. You know, remove all doubt as to what you understand by laying it out. And it seems very inefficient, and it's necessary to shift into a higher gear. Mm.
All those things make complete sense to me. And it seems so obvious, but you even said it was inefficient to stop productivity and get all these people together, but it was so sufficient to making productivity for the future. And I think I'm relating this to what I do because there's so many parallels in improv. We say yes and on stage. Are you familiar with yes and? Okay. So literally it has this same concept of yes, I hear you, and but your and isn't adding, it's just understanding and naming that specific emotion. So you're yes anding using a tactical approach of empathy. It's a yes and of empathy is what it seems like to me. And it seems as if I'm in that audience, I'm a person of that hospital organization, and I walk away feeling understood. It is the greatest catalyst to productivity and change. And all that this president, right, did was get on stage and empathize with this group of human beings to create that change.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And this is such it's a universal skill. This is not just American. Because as we're talking about it, a friend of mine is an international banker. And when his bank had assisted in a buyout of a company in, I believe it was Korea. It was either Korea or Japan. I'm pretty sure it was Korea. And they're like, this American, what's he going to do when he comes in? He's going to upset the apple cart. You know, he doesn't understand us. And he stands up in front of them and he puts up his first slide and he says, I've got on my slide here what's uppermost in all of your minds. And he had it translated into Korean. And the slide said, what's in it for me? Because human beings everywhere, if there's brand new people in charge, there's a new sheriff in town, they want to know how it's going to affect them. Am I going to survive? Am I going to get let go? Am I going to get demoted? Am I going to get a different, you know, what's in it for me is uppermost in everybody's mind when somebody has just taken over their company. They are scared. What's in this for me? I know, you know, all you executives got bought out, all the gold parachutes, all the stock options. You know, I'm a first line troop here. What's in this for me? And he said, when he put that up there and translated it into their language, they started cheering because he demonstrated that he understood what they were thinking. And what they were thinking is, what's in this for me? I'm scared. Mm. Mm.
God, that's so good. I mean, anything, you can literally use that train of thought for building any presentation, any speech, writing any type of literature, writing any type of marketing material, because it's so true. When people read or listen or hear, they are thinking, how can this impact my life? What is it for me?
What does this leave me? Of course, look, I'm a team player. I want all the core values, and I want everybody to hold hands and sing kumbaya. But at the end of the day, if I'm left out, none of this does me any good. So it's in survival. How do I survive? Way back when Maslow's hierarchy of needs, first thing we wonder is how we're going to live. There's some other stuff we're going to wonder about right on the heels of that. But first of all, am I going to survive? What's in it for me?
Oh, so good. Now, okay, empathy and listening. I want to talk about this when it comes to negotiating. Active listening and empathy, are they the same thing or are they different?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I often try to make that distinction with my team because we'll use very specific skills that are designed to trigger decision-making, but are not about listening. Like one of the things we do on a regular basis, one of our main bread and butter skills is I don't try to get you to say yes. I try to get you to say no. I say instead of is now a good time to talk, I'll say is now a bad time to talk. I was on a conference call earlier and I wanted to hand a call off to somebody else on my team. And instead of saying, is it all right if I hand to the CEO on the other side, instead of saying, is it all right if I hand this off to Matt? I said, would you be offended if I handed it off to Matt? He's like, no. So, I would categorize that as empathy, but it's not listening. It's triggering decision making.
Yeah.
In a way that I understand how people's brains work. Now, empathy is about listening is different. Like if I say, so it sounds like you had something in mind. And then I actually listen to the answer and I paraphrase it or I summarize it or I mirror it in some way. I've shown that I was actually listening. And there's a subtlety here that most people miss because it doesn't matter if your answer is accurate if I don't think you listened. Like how much time do you have for somebody that does that? You once you figured out they're not listening to you at all, how much time do you have for them? I ask that question all the time in keynote speeches and people universally say none. Like if I know you're not listening to me, I'm not letting you waste my time. So I'm sitting at a conference several months back, and it has to be people that develop commercial real estate investments, which I don't have any, but I'm interested in. So I'm at the VIP lunch, and the guy I'm sitting next to at the VIP lunch, he's going to try and pitch me. Now, I'm cool with this. I might want to invest. He asked me a great question. I answer it, and he immediately gives me an answer. And I think, all right, so you've been in this business long enough. You know that however I answer is going to be probably one of three ways, and you're going to have a solution for that, which means you didn't actually really listen to me. You were waiting for, am I going to get door number one, door number two, door number three, without taking the time to find out if you heard me. So I thought, all right, I'll respond to his next question. And he hit me with another question, which I answered. And instead of demonstrating in any way, shape, or form that he heard me, boom, he had another answer. So I turned away from him, didn't speak to him again.
I wasn't sure where this was going, Chris, but that is the best answer. Good for you, A. And B, you felt super unheard in that entire scenario. And C, I mean, we can all think about a time, I'm just speaking for the audience and myself here, where we know we're being sold to and it feels icky and it feels gross. And people know that and you knew that. And you're like, peace out, dude.
See you next. And the issue of whether or not his solutions were accurate was irrelevant because at some point in time, he's going to come up with a solution that needs adjustment. And the best indicator of future behavior is past behavior. And so if you haven't listened to me all along the way, then when the time comes where the adjustment is necessary, you're not going to do it. And I'm not interested in that moment coming. It's an inevitable moment. It's a train coming down the tracks. His first and second responses could have been perfect for me. As a matter of fact, I think his first response probably did fit. But I know there's going to come a point in time when it doesn't fit. And if you're not listening, you are never going to be able to make that adjustment. And I don't need that problem.
That's right. That is right. There's so many parallels. Obviously, you're doing it because you're speaking about it. You're writing books. Never Split the Difference is the name of your book. And I want to make sure everybody listening knows and gets a copy of this book. And I want to make sure you can leave a lasting impression on our audience. Truly, I've never talked to anyone like you on this show. So this has been so freaking cool. The work that you do has so many parallels to entrepreneurialism, to corporate America, to leadership. If there's anything that you haven't talked about yet that you want to make sure our audience walks away with today?
These are perishable skills. A friend of mine that used to coach and train that I worked with, Jim Camp, who's now deceased, wrote a book called Start With No. Used to call negotiation a human performance event. So that if you're not working at this, you're getting worse. There's just no way around it. You want to be at the top of your game. You got to be not working hard. This is this growth and change thing that we were talking about earlier. Just a little bit every day. And your skills will continually increase. And if you're not taking the time to show people that you understand, when you really need it, you're not going to be able to do it. So small stakes practice for high stakes results. And you'll be able to produce astonishing results if you give yourself the chance. But you got to keep after it.
I love it. Small steps every day. High stakes.
Amen.
Small to high. I love it. Okay. Now, where can the Improve It peeps find you? Is there anything that you want to give our audience?
Yeah. The best gift I could give you is to get you started with us. We have a newsletter that comes out every Tuesday morning. It's complimentary, but that's not why it's valuable. It's valuable because it's concise and it's usable. It's called The Edge. How do you get on the edge? How you get it is you go to our website, blackswanltd.com, blackswanltd.com. Upper right-hand corner, there's a tab for The Edge. You can get all the back articles, concise, about 700 to 1,000 words, search it by topic, and sign up. Get it emailed to you. You get it Tuesday morning, and it's actionable, and it's the gateway to everything that we have. And we've got a lot of stuff. Wherever you are, we'll meet you where you are. We'll bring you along and you know, have a better life.
Okay. The Edge, Tuesday mornings. We'll put the link in the show notes for everybody. And I have one final question for you, Chris. Improve It is the name of our show, the name of our company. And we always say your it is that thing, that purpose, that reason that you're here on this earth. What is Chris Voss's it?
Yeah, helping people collaborate to have better lives.
I love it. Also, I have to tell you, this has been an incredible conversation. Thank you so much for what you're doing for organizations, for teams, for helping us collaborate. Come full circle on all the things that we've discussed today. All the links will be in the show notes. Chris, you're the man. Thanks for being here.
It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Improve It peeps. What a guy. What a show. I am done. I don't even know where to go from here because we've never had anyone like this on the show. Here's your homework. If you like today's episode, if it spoke to you, if you want more episodes like this about negotiation and standing in your power, your homework is to reach out to us at info@learntoimproveit.com. You can DM me at It's Erin Deal on Instagram or find me on LinkedIn, Erin Deal at Improve It. Y'all, I want to hear from you. That's how we know what you like. So tell me what your thoughts are about this episode. It was quite honestly one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had because we've never talked to an FBI investigator before. So let me know your thoughts. I am so proud of you, and I'm so proud of you for growing, just like Chris said, for investing time, energy, and effort into your growth. Keep failing, keep improving, my friends, because this world needs that very special it that only you can bring. I will see you soon.